It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, June 8th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting sort of live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I've got a secret. We didn't do this show live today. You wouldn't have known if I hadn't told you. Because I know you listen to it on a podcast anyways. Well, at least the vast majority of you. Well, not the vast majority. But thousands upon thousands of you listen to it as a podcast. But I'm just too honest. Hold on for 1 second. I'm just taking a picture of myself and sending it through Twitter. And it is against the Constitution for me to do that without telling you, apparently. Today, ladies and gentlemen, the show is pre-recorded. We are doing some tech work, as it were. And but we have a great show for you, nevertheless. An interview with Christia Friedland. She is chief editor over at Thomson Reuters. You see her sometimes on Radigan. I'm on with her on Radigan. She's on CNBC. She's a financial writer, but more. And she wrote a piece a while back in the Atlantic Monthly, which apparently was an excerpt or part of a book she's working on, The Ruling Elite. Not just in this country, but internationally. She goes to Davos. She hangs out with that dude from PIMCO, all these people. And so she has a very interesting perspective on these people. And we talked about it for, I don't know, what is it, 20 minutes or so? Maybe more.
Yeah, about that.
And a very interesting interview with her. And then, of course, we have a great clip from the great Mike Stark. You all remember Mike Stark? Used to be the guy from Stark Reports, goes around with his video camera. Well, Mike Stark has set up a new site, and he's still calling right-wingers. Today we have a clip of him calling into Rush Limbaugh's show from yesterday, and he reminds Rush Limbaugh that he was stopped at the border with a big bottle of Viagra that was not prescribed to him on his way back from the Dominican Republic. What? There's a lot of prostitutes in the Dominican Republic? But you saying that there are tourists who go down there just for the prostitutes? Oh, I wasn't aware of that. Well, I'm sure it has nothing to do. I'm sure those two things are a coincidence. Even though he was traveling with a bunch of men. I don't know. But Mike Stark reminds him of it, and it's very funny. Limbaugh gets, that's not true. That's an internet rumor. And then he goes on to the, but if it were true, I don't know. And so it's definitely worth listening. You'll enjoy this. And then a couple of pieces of sound, the very brief ones that we didn't get to yesterday. Physicist Mikio Kaku discusses revelations about the severity of what has gone on at Fukushima with Elliot Spitzer on in the arena. And Fukushima is still a major problem, but we're only now starting to really understand the full extent of what the problem could have been. And then just a quick clip from King 5 News in Seattle from back from April. They actually have too much power, because there's more wind and water power than they know what to do with. So they had to shut down part of their grid. It's just worth a little reminder there of what could be. So enjoy this show. It's pre-recorded. But like I said, you wouldn't even known if I hadn't told you. And folks, if you are not a member, and I know you you are not a member because I know who gets this podcast. Some of you, many of you, maybe are new to the show. Maybe you've only been listening for a couple of weeks. Some of you have been listening to the show for the last, how long have we been doing this? 8 months now? Yep. On a daily basis, every day, putting out great content, content you can get nowhere else. I need you to become a member. I know all of you won't, but you, I need you to become a member. Why? Because I don't take money from Soros. I don't take money from Koch brothers. I'm not making them, they're not equivalent in my mind, but I don't take money from anyone except for your fellow members. I don't take money from any corporations. I don't take money from any alliances. I don't take any money from any type of organizations. I have no agenda other than the one that I simply present to you. And the only way I can maintain that is with your membership. And frankly, the only way I can maintain this show is with your membership. We are now starting, although our audience projections are right there, our member projections, we're just about to start to dip underneath them. In fact, we have dipped underneath them. And over the next couple of months, if we don't make up the difference, I honestly don't know if we can maintain the show. This is up to you, folks. So think about the value you get from this show. Is it worth 50 cents a day? Can you get, like, instead of like a double, triple Camiato or whatever it is you get at Starbucks, get a single? Or think about what you pay for cable, for God's sakes. Or look at your credit card bill. I know you're paying $9.99 a month for something you don't even use. So please, if you can become a member, do so. If you can't afford to become a member and want access to the member the entire podcast, email me at Majority Reporters and we can help you out. But if you can't afford it, please, if you want this show to continue, you are the only solution. You're not the final solution. That would be awkward for me to say. All right, folks, enjoy the rest of the program, and we'll be back live tomorrow. So I'm on the phone. I want to welcome to the program, to the Majority Report, Chrystia Freeland. She is the global editor-at-large for Thomson Reuters. And she wrote a piece in the Atlantic Monthly, I guess several months ago now, that I know, Chrystia, you're working into a book entitled The Rise of the New Global Elite. Thanks so much for taking some time to talk to me about it.
It's my pleasure, Sam. I always enjoy being on Dylan's show with you, so it's nice to actually come on your show.
And you should also know that last week I was on with Larry Kudlow, and I quoted at least the response to your question on Meet the Press from a couple of weeks ago with David Stockman. He didn't like the idea that I had told him that his former boss reminded everyone that Reagan raised taxes. But so I want to thank you for that while I have you on the line.
Well, thank you, and I do think, although this does touch somewhat on the global super elite issue, but I think we have to keep on reminding people that the sainted Ronald Reagan did in fact raise taxes.
Right, he also, in addition to raising taxes, he still sort of left us without a revenue source that was even further depleted by George Walker Bush. But let's talk about that, because this sort of it's somewhat tangential, but maybe not so much to your piece. You start off your piece with a quote from three analysts at Citigroup, who in 2005 reported to investors that the world is dividing into two blocks, the plutonomy and the rest. Tell us what that means.
Well, what they basically sort of noted, and I think that it was, and what was interesting for me about that report was it wasn't partisan or ideological. They were trying to figure out what's happening in the world so that you can build investing strategies around it. And what they reported, I think, is something that's happening, which is what we're seeing.
Uh-oh.
But also in the emerging markets, is the super elites, the people at the very top, you know, the top 1%, pulling away from everybody else. And increasingly, because we are living in a global economy where capital flows are global, where a lot of supply chains are global, where companies are global, that super elite is doing business with itself. And I think increasingly is living in a world which is, you know, sort of a nation unto itself. One of the people I talked to for my piece said, you know, I probably have more in common with someone who's running an investment bank in Africa, this was a New York private equity guy, than I do with my neighbors in Connecticut. And that person running the bank in Africa probably has more in common with me. So I think that that's something that's happening, and it's happening in the United States, but crucially, it's happening all over the world.
I mean, this may be jumping ahead a little bit, but there's almost an analogy to be made with what the internet did for everything from hobbies to political organizing, that we've entered into a realm where geography is less relevant and more psychography, I guess, is more relevant. But in this case, it's organized by the accumulation of massive amounts of money.
Yeah, you know what? I think that that is a really smart observation, Sam. And I think, you know, when you put it like that, you know, there's, at some level, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. And it's kind of natural that as it becomes easier for us to spend more time and sort of to inhabit a space that is more exclusively populated by people with shared interests, shared background, shared business, that is going to be what we're all going to do. And we're all sorting ourselves that way. Where I think it becomes something that has more social and political significance than, say, people with an interest in knitting hanging out with each other and people with an interest in football also hanging out with each other, I think that this does have a political and economic and social impact. And, you know, the people, that top 1%, that global super elite, they're the people who control the money in the world. They control most of the world's economy. And what I think is happening, partly because of this sorting effect, is those people have a perception of what's happening in the world, which is maybe a perception and a set of self-interests, which is increasingly separate from that of national geographic communities.
And you also raise early in the piece the issue that it's not simply a plutonomy in the sense that there is a separate economy for extremely wealthy people, but there's also a plutocracy in the sense that these people are actually have more influence. And I think at this point, certainly from the perspective of my audience, this is something that I think everyone is aware of, but they have an inordinate amount of influence upon our society and our political system.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, recent decisions by the Supreme Court in the United States have made that even more the case, making it easier for rich people and rich companies, you know, to directly underwrite the political process. But I think, you know, as you're seeing these greater concentrations of wealth, it's going to be inevitable that those individuals who control that money are going to use it to have a political influence. And that's where, you know, the sorting does start having a pernicious effect, because no matter actually what your sort of natural or original politics or ideology is, once you move into the super elite and start hanging out almost entirely with fellow members of this super elite, you're going to start seeing the world from that perspective.
And
that, you know, for example, in the sorry, Sam, to interrupt, but, you know, I think that's going to be particularly relevant when it comes to the budget debate, because so much of what is being debated is actually cutting government spending on programs for poor people in the middle class. If you're in the top 0.5%, none of those cuts are going to have any direct impact on your life.
Right, and in fact, Pete Peterson, I think, and you mentioned Pete Peterson actually as the day of June 21st, 2007, when Pete Peterson's Blackstone went public. Pete Peterson is a perfect example of that type of guy who is both someone who probably has absolutely no sense as to what a the difference on $400 or $500 worth of Social Security payments mean to two-thirds of our seniors, or the idea that you would have to work an extra year or two before you can actually retire, because he's a billionaire and undoubtedly rarely sees these people. And he's also someone who, maybe not coincidentally, has been pouring literally hundreds of millions of dollars into an effort to do that very thing, to cut Social Security. So he's sort of working it from both ends.
Yeah, and I mean, look, on Pete Peterson in particular, you know, I think that he presents in his campaign for, you know, fiscal discipline, I think that that is, you know, a very long-held, strongly held intellectual point of view. And, you know, in contrast with, you know, the lobbying in Washington, you know, we can't argue that he is taking that position because he stands personally to benefit from it. And I think, you know, he's a conviction actor in this space. Having said that, you know, it is easier to believe in an austerity that actually isn't going to affect you, your family, anybody you know. I think you know that's an issue, right?
Yeah, but I want to talk about that because, you know, one of the things about your piece, and it really is fascinating, and, you know, of course we'll link it to it on our blog, and it's fascinating to see this perspective of the plutocracy and the disdain in which they, to a certain extent, you capture their feelings towards what would really constitute 80% of the American population on some level. And but I wanted to because you hang out with these people more than anyone I know, and which I think is a tremendous asset to all of us who want to understand this. But you mentioned that Pete Peterson is a guy who acts out of conviction as opposed to just the material benefit he gets from it. And I wouldn't have a problem with that because I frankly think it's impossible for a guy who has $1 billion for the actual accrual of any more material benefit. The value of each subsequent $100 million you get after $1 billion, I would imagine, does nothing in terms of materially changing your life. But I would argue or want to hear your perspective on whether or not that each $100 million that comes in after that first billion or whatever the figure is, it reinforces his sense that he is a moral actor or in some respects, a better person. I mean, you mention the disdain and the blame later in the piece that these plutocrats tend to put on middle-class people who were maybe too aggressive in buying loans or too ignorant in securing loans, rather. Isn't it quite possible that while he is working clearly from a conviction, that conviction is that ultimately society should have almost Gallatin overlords who accrue more money, vast sums of money, in a way that their underlings never did? I mean, I would imagine kings back in the day also felt it was a conviction that they should have control of societies in a way that the peasants aren't morally valid to.
Right. Well, you make an excellent point, and it is certainly the case that elites tend to find ideological ways to justify their elite position. So we've had the divine right of kings,
you know, in societies like India, you have a whole, you know, religious structure designed to justify the existence of an elite and the oppression of other people. And I think, you know, there is actually some very interesting research by behavioral economists, in particular Dan Ariely, who has done some work showing that, you know, with some, you know, very specific clinical studies, showing that when subjects are given a material interest in a particular outcome, they actually change their views. So it doesn't become a hypocrisy. It's not that you sort of are hypocritically or cynically arguing in favor of something that will give you a material benefit. They actually change their thinking about whether things are good or bad or right or wrong. And I do think that that happens with the super elite. And that's part of the reason that I think that, you know, we need to be concerned about the political consequences about this income polarization and also this separation between the super rich and everybody else. What I think it makes the situation in some ways even more complicated is that it just so happens, you know, because of the economic forces that are creating this phenomenon right now, in the real super elite group, and I'm now talking about, you know, the top 0.5%, not the top 5%. Mm-hmm. So at the very, very top, these tend to be people who are largely self-made. Now, I'm not saying that these are people who started out in the gutter. They probably started out middle class or even upper middle class. But it is, you know, more, you know, the sons of dentists like Mark Zuckerberg, or the sons of shoe salesmen. That's Larry Fink, one of the big asset managers in New York. Those are the kind of people who are becoming members of the super elite, who are really making personal fortunes. And why I think this is a complicating factor is I think that if you made your money yourself and you started out in the middle class, you probably have a set of beliefs about social mobility, mm-hmm. Around the notion that, well, I did it so anybody can, which may be true to your life experience, but statistically just not true to everybody else. So, you know, there is both maybe a greater sympathy and understanding of the middle class among these guys because they started out where we are, but at the same time, maybe a false sense of how easy and how possible it is to get to the very top.
Right. And perhaps I mean give me your sense of where that falls, because my sense is that more often than not when I encounter that dynamic, it tends to be a certain amount of it's doable. I proved that it's doable, and it must be just as doable for anybody else. An ability to ignore luck at certain times, or just simply law of averages.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Look, I mean, and I think that's natural. You know, if
right.
you did something, it's pretty natural to think other people can do it too. And what I do think gets overlooked, and I think that this is just, you know, a tendency of human psychology, what I think does get overlooked is the amount of luck that was probably involved, the amount of being in exactly the right place at exactly the right time, and the extent to which, you know, so much of this is a lottery and a winner-take-all lottery. I think we see that most clearly in Silicon Valley, where it's certainly the case that the successful entrepreneurs are brilliant, but there are lots of brilliant guys in Silicon Valley, and very few of them end up being the guy who creates Facebook. Part of that, you know, is you know, brilliance being a better engineer, a better programmer than everybody else, a better businessman. But a lot of it surely has to be just being at the right place at the right time. And, you know, the reality of the income distribution, you know, what the statistics tell us is, you know, it is kind of a lottery system right now. And you know, that top, if you manage to get into the top 1%, the top 0.5%, the system is working terrifically for you. But for everybody else, it's not so great. And that's true increasingly even, you know, for people who used to think of themselves as kind of comfortably in the upper middle class.
Right.
You know, a lot of those more upper end white collar jobs, those are now the ones starting to be, you know, chipped away by globalization, by the technology revolution. An interesting profession to look at is the legal profession, where at the very, very top you're seeing superstar salaries, higher than you ever saw before. But you're also seeing quite a few unemployed lawyers and law school graduates.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we should say that, you quote Peter Lindert, an economist at the University of California, Davis, who studies the history of economies and marks this 30-year period that has led to this point as being something that's completely unprecedented in terms of this wealth disparity that's growing. And I would agree with you that I think the real fulcrum here is probably that second quintile. People who have been the 60 to 80 percent income distribution in this country, at least in this country, in terms of they're starting to feel the squeeze in a way that people already below them on the income distribution scale have already felt for years. So this is something that's genuinely new for these people. But to get back to your piece, you mentioned that These super elite, they gather in their own sort of like social circles. You talk about Davos, and I think, you know, around the time of this piece or shortly after it, I read a piece that Hosni Mubarak's son was in fact a guy who regularly went to Davos and had introduced many of those lessons that he had learned at Davos into Egypt's economy over the years, and we saw where that led. Do you have a sense, I mean, what is the end game here? Because when you have a situation where the global elite are living in their own metaphorical, if not real, gated communities, isn't this the time where they can get blindsided by the implication of what's happening?
Yeah, I certainly think that's the case. I mean, to take the American parallel, you know, the best historical parallel in America is the Gilded Age, when you also had this time of incredibly turbulent economic change, an incredibly dynamic economy. You had had, you know, the Industrial Revolution, the opening up of the American West, the building of the railroads, all these great and important things happening. And in terms of income distribution, you know, the consequence was, as one important book of the 19th century had it, you know, it was a time of progress and poverty. The guys at the very top, you know, the robber barons doing incredibly well, but, you know, real poverty at the bottom, a real squeeze. And the result of that was very, very turbulent, even violent politics. And ultimately, you had the two Roosevelts in, you know, different periods, engaging in trust busting and in building the great society. And that was the political response, in a way, actually, you know, interestingly, done by those two members of the New York elite, because that ultimately, although fiercely resisted by the elite at the time, those turned out to be incredibly successful policies for the U.S. economic elite, because it ended up preserving the system and preserving the status of those elites. You know, compare the fate of the U.S. elite in the 20th century to the fates of the European elites. Much, much better to be an American capitalist in the 20th century than a European one. And I think, you know, that class owes its continued prosperity, paradoxical though it might sound, to those concessions that were made to the rest of society. We seem to me to be in a period when another, you know, moment like that seems to be dawning. Having said that, you know, while that, you know, the facts seem to me to argue the need for that, when I look at American politics, that doesn't seem to be happening.
Well, and is it possible that, and I agree with your assessment of that, at the end of the day, this was the the New Deal, for instance, ended up providing American capitalists a sense of security, at least, and stability in, from which to grow upon, and which could have easily been lost, I think, in what could have come out of the Great Depression. But is it possible that these people not only are not aware of that, because you quote hedge fund, hedge fund guys who talk about one of his senior colleagues had argued that the hollowing out of the American middle class really didn't matter. His point was, if the transformation of the world economy lifts four people in China and India out of poverty and into middle class, and meanwhile means one American drops out of the middle class, that's not such a bad trade. In other words, the calculus is that what happens in America is not terribly relevant to my bottom line if it is more than made up with citizenry from around the world. To a certain extent, isn't it the case that in some ways the fate and the lack of stability that is potentially involved in what's happening in this country no longer has the leverage over these people that it did back in the 20s and 30s?
That is absolutely the case, and that is one of the real complicating factors today. Is, you know, we really, you know, all this stuff that people say about globalization, it's not just blah blah. It's really true, and it means that, you know, big American companies nowadays, you know, increasingly more and more of them are doing more than half of their business outside the United States, and are tending to move more and more of their business outside the United States. So the sort of political leverage that, you know, the American body politic can have over them is much less than it used to be. And I think that that does complicate how you think about what public policies you are going to apply. You know, at the end of the day, it's not wrong when some of these people say, look, you impose overly onerous taxes and business will just leave the country. That could happen. At the same time, you know, I think so. Someone has to pay the taxes. Someone has to help pay down the budget deficit. And at a time when the middle class is so squeezed, it seems absolutely the right thing that the people at the top should be doing it. So I think it creates a really complicated policy situation.
It's interesting because you wrap up the piece by saying the real threat facing the super elite at home and abroad isn't modestly higher taxes. I mean, because, of course, these people, we now have the wealthy in the country paying their smallest portion of their – as measured by their income – in effective taxes or effective taxes relative to GDP than we've had in over 60 years. But you say, but you write, but rather the possibility that public rage could cohere into a more concrete populist agenda. That is, for instance, middle class Americans could conclude that the world economy isn't working for them and decide that protectionism or truly punitive taxation is preferable to incremental measures, such as the eventual repeal of upper bracket tax cuts. Now, of course, you know, taxation is – even punitive taxation is much easier to escape. This hedge fund guy who comes into New York, he decides I'm going to move to Switzerland. And I've had people argue to me that, you know, you change hedge fund taxes from capital gains to income tax, then these people are just going to move out of the country and escape it that way. But they can't escape protectionism. And so do you think that as a – if you were to look at this, and I know that you don't necessarily do so, but if one was to look at this in terms of what would be the most effective agitation in terms of public policy – that would show and use the remaining leverage that the middle class would have in this country, is something like a new type of protectionism the strongest cudgel, I guess?
So I personally think it's the wrong cudgel, because I think, you know, the trick that you want to pull off is to make your companies and your economy as effective as possible. I don't think you actually want to stand in the way of companies becoming more efficient and productive. You know, let's think back to the Industrial Revolution and the Luddites. You know, the guys who were, you know, breaking the new machines. They were right from their own self-interested point of view. And, you know, I think maybe now that we see similar processes affecting us, we might have more sympathy for those movements than we did when we studied them in junior high, and it just seemed absurd. But on balance, it's a great thing we had the Industrial Revolution, right? It helped everybody. And I do think that global trade, on balance, overall, does make the economy more productive. It creates a bigger pie. The problem is that pie is really not being shared. And so, you know, my dream policy solutions would involve trying not to mess around with the making of bigger and bigger pies. And here environmentalists might disagree with me, but there you go. But trying to do what you can on the distribution end. Having said that, particularly because of how the debate around tax is happening in the United States, and it does mystify me a little bit, the nature of that debate, I do think that the more likely outcome is going to be some form of protectionism. And we already see that certainly in terms of the language around China.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because, you know, it's come up in many different conversations I've had with people around this topic that this Princeton study from 2007, Martin Gillens, he basically showed that the policy outcomes over the past 30 or 40 years have always favored wealthy interests, regardless of who's in office. And we're at a time where I think that, you know, Barack Obama, I think, who many perceive to be a guy who certainly on the right, they perceived him to be someone who was interested in income redistribution. Many on the left, I think, sort of felt the same way. And I think to a certain extent, he is also a product of one of those guys who came from humble beginnings and perceives the meritocracy as working perhaps better than it actually does. We all base our views on our own personal experience, and for him it worked quite well. For many in this country, and many more, it's not. And I guess what I'm asking is, what is the greatest threat? I mean, we see many times where people threaten in a political arena to do X when they actually have no intention of doing X. We see it with the Republicans and the debt ceiling. But they do this because this is where they see the greatest amount of leverage. Do you think that trade policy, while perhaps may involve cutting off one's nose to spite one's face, I guess, might be that greatest lever?
Maybe. I mean, I just don't. The problem with protectionism, you know, in addition to the dangers it would pose, you know, to the effectiveness of U.S. companies, is it ends up benefiting only a very particular group of people, right? You know, the people, certain groups of workers might, at least for a while, be better off with protectionism, but I don't think it solves the really big problem. And, you know, what I think is happening in, you know, very broad strokes, when you think about what's happening in the world economy right now, is, you know, basically we're having a second industrial revolution, only this time it's happening in Asia. And Asia missed out on the industrial revolution. You know, so Asia is 200 years behind the West, but it's having its industrial revolution now, and there are a lot of people there, and they are coming online into the world economy. So if you are doing any kind of a job that's part of that pool of workers, you know, your wage and the wage of somebody doing it in China are going to have to equal out. And, you know, maybe 50 years from now, that will all be okay. But the process is going to take a long time and be incredibly painful for the middle class. In the meantime, if you're at the very top and you're kind of surfing these waves of globalization and technological change, you're doing better than ever before. I think that we need to rethink how society and government work overall based on, you know, with as our base case the fact that this is how it's working now and this is how it's going to work, you know, I think for another generation. And really rethink, you know, some of the basic issues of what do we provide to everybody. Now, right. That's just so radical in the U.S. context. So I would say, you know, universal health care, that should be job one. Great public education for everybody. And then, you know, think about ways that you can create true society and true democracy in a time in history when we are going to have, I think structurally for a while, this income stratification. And I do think it means we have to think really radically about how things work. You know, a good country to think about, I think, is Germany. Because Germany does seem at the moment to be performing better than any other Western industrialized country. I know that's anathema to Americans right. who like to think that Europe is just a terrible museum that doesn't do anything. But the Germans are doing pretty well. Their economy is growing strongly. And
They've done this by spending. I mean, they've been spending quite a bit, haven't they?
Well, they've done it partly by spending, but also, you know, the engine room of their economy works differently. So when the big recession hit, instead of German companies behaving the way Americans ones did and, you know, laying some people off, the remaining workers working harder, being more productive, the company doing better, the pain was spread out among everybody. Fewer people were laid off, but everybody worked fewer hours.
Right. So you had four-day work weeks. And
Right. And that, you know, that means everybody had some pain. Everybody was taking home less money. But more of a sense, you know, dare I say it, of social solidarity.
And we should say in a place in like Germany, you're taking home less money, but your basic needs like health care and education are already covered for.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's, you know, I think Americans don't fully appreciate how bad it is to be poor and unemployed in America. You know, the thought in most Western industrialized countries, healthcare is just not a concern. It's not a financial. It's a concern. We all care about our health, but it is not a financial concern. And there is not a big difference between the care you get if you're poor and if you're rich. Now, that's a big social choice. And, you know, judging by the healthcare debates, it's not a choice that Americans are prepared to make. But, you know, I think that
I'm not convinced about that, but be that as it may. I mean, you know,
I hope you're right. I hope you're right. But, you know, the need for these. So I think that there's a really perverse moment in U.S. politics because the need for these kinds of social programs today, just given the structure of the U.S. and global economy, is greater than at other times. And yet, you know, the support for it is less.
At least amongst our leaders.
Right?
I mean, if you look at polls, though, I mean, the most recent poll by Quinnipiac said 70 to 75%, depending on how much you explain to them what part of the budget Medicare is, do not want Medicare touched. Same with Social Security, 70 to 75%. There's only a 5-point swing when they are showed the budget. But people want defense cut. Now, that's not on the table. People want the raising of taxes of people making over $250,000. I bet you the people there's even sort of surprising numbers for raising of taxes across the board. But this is not completely excluded from our political discourse. I mean, it's stunning. It's not even, you know, the Progressive Caucus came out with a budget, but the amount of ink that's been spent on that, I have more in my pen. It's stunning. And I guess that's why I was asking in terms of not so much from a policy, because I think from a policy standpoint, I would agree that protectionism isn't necessarily the best solution. But from a political standpoint, the issue is if the New Deal came in part because there was a fear by the some quarters of the capitalist elite that there could be some greater losses, then perhaps we're at another time where we need to see a movement that will scare them enough to make a compromise, like some form of redistribution.
Yeah, I mean, what I will be interested in is, I think so far the budget debate, not the state level cuts, but sort of the big national budget debate, so far are largely about rhetoric.
Mm-hmm.
And at the rhetorical level, it can sound kind of good to say, okay, we're going to cut taxes, and yes, we're going to cut spending, but it's just going to be, you know, this heroic thing. It's kind of like, it reminds me a little bit about the feel-good feeling you get when you make your New Year's resolutions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to go on a diet, and, you know, that's going to be so great. And I'm going to actually enjoy that period of austerity. It will be really interesting to see what happens when, we go from talking about the diet to actually being hungry. And one of the places that I think we should all be watching is the UK, because, you know, the Conservative government was very aggressive about it. You know, we're the warriors. We're going to be the great austerity guys. We're the great hawks. And people actually liked that. That was appealing to people, that sort of, you know, stiff upper lip, British spirit, all the rest of it. Now that people are actually experiencing it, we're seeing the British economy contract, you know, really dreadfully. Housing prices fall, you know, quite a vicious spiral is developing. We're seeing a lot less enthusiasm for it. So you might see maybe what it's going to take to shift American politics is not protectionism, but people actually seeing what the translation of that rhetoric into reality means.
And then the reactions, just how people react to it, if they do so, I guess, in the political sphere. It'll be interesting because one wonders – I mean, I think the really dangerous thing here is that there does not seem to be a natural leadership constituency to – address the implications of austerity in this country. In other words, the Democratic Party, at least the rudder of whatever the Democratic Party is these days, does not seem to be terribly responsive to these issues. And sadly, I think to the extent that there's any protectionism, you know, when Donald Trump comes out and starts talking about, I'm going to swear at China, the reason why I think it excites some quarters of society is because nobody is addressing these feelings that the middle class is having that they're getting screwed.
I think you're completely right, Sam. And what is sort of shocking to me is that so far, actually, the right has done a better job of at least creating a framework that's asking the questions than mm-hmm. the left has done. You know, the Tea Party really is, I think, a somewhat inchoate but passionate response by the middle class and mostly actually the white middle class to not just this sense, but to the reality of an economy that isn't working out for them.
Right. I mean, I think that's what the right is very smart about. They get out in front of that and they frame it in such a way so that the answer very often is you're getting screwed, middle class, because of welfare.
Yeah.
Because of the 300 million teat suckers that Alan Simpson called them, or because of Medicare and Medicaid. And, you know, there's I think there's a decent amount of at least academic work that shows that the association this mostly white group of people have on as to who exactly those teat suckers are and those users of Medicare and Medicaid do not look like them. And
right.
And so that, I think, they have more of an agenda to get out in front of that so that they can frame this conversation and really dispel it. But you're right, the left in this country seems to have at least the institutional, the political institutions are not addressing it.
And I do think that this is one, it shows me something, which, you know, a mistake that I participated in making. But, you know, remember, there has been a trendiness, and it continues now, a view that, you know, you need to means test government programs. And,
mm-hmm.
and to have universal government programs is just dumb because, you know, it's not cost effective and, you know, rich people don't need the programs. You're seeing this debate, you know, this view be expressed, you know, again today. The problem with that is while it's economically smart, it's politically mistaken. And what you do when you shift all of your social programs to being means tested is you create a situation where very directly the rich are paying for the poor rather than the rich paying for everybody. And while that might work for a few years, it then the next inevitable step becomes the rich saying, wait a minute, why are we paying for this at all?
Right.
And I think that that could be why you see more support for these programs in countries where the welfare state is really delivering something good for everybody. So countries, you know, once a country has a universal national health care system, there's no example of it being rejected.
Right.
There's lots of tweaking. You know, everybody constantly bitches about their health care, but, you know, Western Europe, Canada have had national health care systems for decades, and no politician would dare to talk about going to a privatized system because everybody is invested in it and everybody knows that, you know, it delivers something pretty good.
Well, Social Security went that same way, but, you know, the reality is, too, is that from an economic standpoint, if you're talking about Social Security at least, I've seen data on this that there is really no significant savings because if you look at Social Security, you see that the bottom 60% of the country rely on Social Security for over 50% of their income. That last quintile, the 60 to 80%, something like 45% of their income in retirement is a function of Social Security. The fact is that the amount of people who don't need Social Security is so small that the savings are virtually nil. Relatively speaking, so that there isn't even really the economic wisdom. I actually think that it is the political argument why people want to do that, because they do want to untether it in that way. But it's I guess we'll see how this plays out. And but I just want to encourage, I know you're writing this piece as a book, and we're very excited for you to finish. Not rushing you, but to read.
I submitted
more.
A chapter to my editor at 1 o'clock yesterday morning, so I'm working on it.
Well done, well done. Well, we have the piece, The Rise of the Global, a New Global Elite, up at majority.fm. I encourage everybody to read this piece. It's a fascinating view into the minds and the characters of these people, which I think is really important, as at least from my perspective, we try and figure out a way how we can leverage them to start to share a little more.
Thank you very much, Sam, and I look forward to seeing you in a green room sometime soon.
Yes. Thank you, Krista Freeman.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks.
Starting in Arlington, Virginia, this is Seth. Welcome, sir. Nice to have you on the EIB Network. Hello.
Thank you, Russ. I'm looking at this, and I'm seeing two adults exchanging, or actually seven if there's six women, exchanging pictures in a consensual way. And I guess it's none of my business. It was none of the reporter's business. It was none of anyone else's business. How is this different? I mean, you're talking about how smart everybody is. You tell us how smart you are every day. But how is this different from you going to, you know, the sexual tourist destination of Dominican Republic with a bottle of Viagra and having that splayed all over the headlines? How did you like that? Why is this different?
Well, but what you describe about me isn't true. And I guess what you're suggesting here is that getting caught having sex affairs is only stupid when Republicans do it.
No.
But I didn't. No, this, you know, you're repeating internet rumors based in hatred and misinformation and typical brainlessness on the left. None of that which you described took place whatsoever. But you know what? Even if it had, it doesn't change what Wiener did. And it doesn't change the way Wiener has handled it. And it doesn't change what Bill Clinton did. And it doesn't change Bill Clinton lying under oath. It doesn't change any of the reprobate activities that the Democrats and leaders of that party have engaged in. It doesn't change a thing. Now, if you want to take refuge, and if you want to seek comfort, you want to try to excuse this depravity by believing BS and believing lies and getting your jollies by calling here and repeating that stuff, you might as well have thrown in some of the quotes that I never said about slavery when trying to buy a part of the St. Louis Rams. But it's people like you who present the rest of us with the greatest challenge we have in saving the country, because general glittering jewels of colossal ignorance like you and your hate-filled partisanship are primarily responsible. People just like you are primarily responsible for the precarious position this great nation finds itself in, because you can't be counted on for genuine, decent citizenship. You can't be counted on to protect this country when it's under assault internally. You seek your jollies in false victories over your political enemies while your country is in the process of going down in flames. It's people like you that try to make excuses for reprobates like Wiener and Clinton and so forth while immersing yourself in lies to make yourself feel good that present a problem for the rest of us. Feel sorry for you. You're probably capable of much more than you're immersing yourself in. I got to take a brief time out. We'll be back. We'll continue right after this.
Last week, there was this enormous bombshell dropped by the government. They finally admitted there was 100% core melt in Unit 1, possibly in Units 2 and 3. All these reassuring, soothing words mean nothing. 100% core melt. What stopped the reactor accident at the time was the sudden influx of seawater. If they didn't put that seawater in at the right moment, we would have lost northern Japan. That's how close we came to a national, worldwide tragedy.
Okay, I just want to make sure people understand. 100% core melt means what?
It means that the core of uranium, which is 100 tons, measuring about 12 feet tall, is now basically a bowl of granola, granola with cream on it. That's what it looks like.
Explain this to me. It melted down into this mess.
It melted down and crumbled into this mess. There's nothing recognizable in the core. If you were to take a TV camera down there and photograph it, it's like a pile of splintered granola with cream. That's what it looks like.
And so that whole time when people were saying, when some people were saying we have a meltdown and the government was saying, no meltdown, it was a meltdown.
It was a meltdown. 100% core melt. And what prevented the reactor from simply going out of control and exploding was the fact that they dumped seawater into the cores, stopping the accident. And this is not in any textbook. No textbook says, as a last-ditch measure, dump seawater to stop three simultaneous meltdowns.
Okay, so it stopped the meltdown because the water simply absorbed the heat and dissipated it. But the downside risk was the seawater then went back into the ocean and dissipated, and the radioactivity was spread
around. The problem is you have all this salt, you have all this radioactive water, and the Chinese and the Koreans have protested because of the fact that they were dumping radioactive seawater into the ocean. Radioactive levels began to soar. People were concerned about plant life, about seafood. It created a huge mess, and it's still going on. Realize that school children right now are going to be exposed to 20 times the level that an atomic worker is going to be exposed. This is so bad that one of the advisors of the prime minister quit. He quit in protest and said that I'm not going to let my children be exposed to 20 times the radiation of what an atomic worker would get.
The Northwest has more electricity than it can handle, and that's why some wind generators may go offline. The Bonneville Power Administration says there's so much water running through its dams this year that wind turbines may need to be taken offline because the power grid just can't handle the overload. Wind power advocates say investments must be made to change the infrastructure.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light. The choice is made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somehow lost my drive.